What is the perfect story? Does it exist? Is there a tangible formula? Has the perfect story ever been told? And if so, are we simply trying to retell this story over and over? This podcast is called The Midnight Myth, and somewhere between the black of night and the break of dawn, there is a story, and it's perfect. My name is Derek Jones.
And my name is Laurel Hostack.
Welcome to The Midnight Myth. Welcome back to the Midnight Myth, everybody's favorite history, mythology, philosophy, pop culture podcast. I am very excited to be back here with another Midnight Myth episode this week. This one has been a long time coming. We're tackling one of my all-time favorites, one of the most influential movies of my life, influential in terms of the industry, influential in terms of how much it sparked my imagination, influential in how it shaped pop culture. This movie is a behemoth. We are now in episode 4 of our sci-fi series.
Yeah.
So this is our fourth experiment on dealing strictly with sci-fi properties. We have done an episode on 2001: A Space Odyssey. It is about sci-fi as optimism, as hopeful. Then we did sci-fi as horror in Alien. And then we did sci-fi as a Shakespearean slash operatic adventure in space in Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan. And now we're going to sci-fi as, I don't even know as what, as apocalyptic.
Sci-fi as action, blockbuster, apocalyptic. Meditations on fate and prophecy and human responsibility.
This is a story that's going to take place 100% on planet Earth. It is not going to involve going and exploring the deepest reaches of space. We are going to be talking about the behemoth, the amazing, the fantastic, Terminator 2.
Judgment Day. I am super excited to be taking this on and to hear about your passion for this movie, Derek, especially because, as you know, I had never seen a Terminator movie before this week when we started working on this episode. And this has been a really cool series where we have watched things that we are either super familiar with or like, you know, saw a really long time ago, but like have still remember as being amazing. And this for me is a totally brand new, like, I can't believe I've never seen a Terminator movie, but it had to happen someday. And so it might as well happen for the podcast. So I'm coming into it with really fresh eyes, and I didn't watch the original movie and I don't plan on watching any of the sequels anytime soon, probably someday, but I'm seeing this kind of as an isolated experience. And, you know, interesting that it's going to follow from The Wrath of Khan, because these are two iconic sequels that are generally considered to be superior to what came before. So it's cool that we get the opportunity in this sci-fi series to talk about successful sequels, which there are so few of those and so few critically successful sequels out there that get the attention that things like The Wrath of Khan and Terminator 2 do. So very cool, interesting similarity there, and I'm excited to dive in.
To be fair, the first Terminator movie is awesome.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's fantastic. However, T2 stands alone in all of the Terminator movies. The reason Terminator movies are still being made, it's to chase the success and replicate the success of T2. And that movie is huge. I mean, everyone in a generation knows the phrase, hasta la vista, baby.
Or I'll be back.
Because of Terminator 2.
Yeah.
It has that much of an imprint on our pop culture because that movie was such a smash hit. I can't wait to talk about it through the Midnight Myth history, mythology, philosophy lens. It's going to be tons of fun. I am ready to roll up my sleeves. I say that I'm wearing a tank top because it's really hot in Philadelphia.
It's so hot.
So I'm not wearing any sleeves and do get, you know, busy on Terminator 2. I just want to say one quick thing too.
Yeah.
I hope everyone's doing well out there. I know we all want the pandemic to be over. It's not. It's still raging through many parts of America and other parts of the world here. And I just want to send my love to everyone. We hear your frustrations. Stay safe. A really good friend of mine probably has COVID. Not sure yet. Hasn't gotten the test back, but is really, really sick. Thankfully, not life-threatening sick, but still really, really sick. It's very real. Stay safe. Wear a mask. Protect yourself. Protect your family.
Yeah. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Use common sense. Get a test if you can. You would be surprised. There are a lot of places in the country where you can get a free and fast test, regardless of whether you have symptoms or health insurance. So look into those things. I know in our state and in several other states, we were able to secure COVID tests via Project Baseline. So if you're looking for where to get that done, visit Project Baseline's website. I'll pop that in our show notes so that you can check it out. It took 5 minutes and was maybe the weirdest feeling experience of my life, but was absolutely worth it. So highly recommend.
And for the love of God, wear a mask, or for the love of Odin, as I'd rather say, wear a mask out there. Please protect each other. My friend that most likely has COVID got it from working a job where patrons of the establishment he worked at were not wearing masks. And that's how he most likely got it. We don't have the test back yet. You know what? Let's forego all the normal Midnight Myth plugs. You guys know how to reach us.
Yeah, and it'll all be in our show notes. You know where to find us. But yeah, this is super important.
Really is. We have to do our best to stem the tide of this virus. And we're not getting leadership in America from our president, who is a buffoon. And we really need to take it on ourselves to keep each other safe by wearing a mask, socially distanced. It's the only way we're going to get through this. And we will get through it. This is not our judgment day. This is just one blip on the radar. And it's a really awful crisis point. So I don't mean to minimize anyone's pain, but we will get through it. We have to take care of each other, because we don't actually have a leader that'll help us through it.
Yep, it's on all of us. And as Sarah Connor reflects at the end of this movie, if a Terminator can learn the value of human life, maybe we can too. And that's what this is going to take. This is going to take every single one of us putting other people before ourselves, like learning the value of every single human life, because so many of them have already been lost and so many are in danger. So we'll get much more into those themes as we discuss Terminator 2, but just keep that in mind. Like, this is not something where we can all be in it for ourselves. We have to be in it for each other, and it's going to be hard, hard work, but we're going to get there.
I love that. Shall we begin the show then?
Yeah, absolutely.
Briefest of brief recaps, as always.
Please be my guest, sir.
Terminator 2, we've all seen it. I don't need to go crazy. It's the story of two different Terminator machines, which are killer robots from the future, sent back in the past to try to kill John Connor, who, after the robots set off nuclear Armageddon in the 90s, because that's how old this movie is, there is the rise of the machines that try to exterminate the rest of the remaining living humans, and John Connor rallies them for a heroic resistance to try to defeat the machines and reclaim the planet. The machines don't like this, so they send two Terminators back in time. One is the T-1000, who is a shape-changing liquid metal robot. The other one is a regular Terminator who looks, acts, and sounds exactly like the Terminator from the first movie. And the T-1000 is trying to kill John Connor, while the Arnold Schwarzenegger regular Terminator is trying to protect him. They spring their mother from the mental institution that she's in because she's trying to warn everyone about Judgment Day. They try to escape. Sarah Connor then decides, mother of John Connor, that she's going to change the future by killing Miles Dyson, who invents the Skynet computer, which would become the AI intelligence, which would destroy humanity through nuclear apocalypse and then bring the machines and the rise of the Terminators. She ultimately does not kill Miles Dyson, but together they decide they're going to destroy all of his work, including the computer chip and arm from the original Terminator from the first movie, which is the basis of Miles Dyson's work. All hell breaks loose. A humongous battle ensues between the Terminator and all of the police, and then they have to fight the T-1000. They destroy the T-1000. After this, the Terminator, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Uncle Bob, has learned the value of human life and nobly sacrifices himself so that he is destroyed, so there is no remaining evidence of the Terminators, in the hopes that perchance humans won't invent Skynet. And the movie ends with Sarah Connor not knowing the future for the first time in a long time.
Yeah, moving forward with a little bit of uncertainty, which, while uncertainty is often a very uncomfortable place to live because you don't know what's coming, for her, it's very hopeful because she goes from being someone who knows exactly what's coming, this bleak and brutal, dismal future where people are destroyed horribly. That's erased. And now there's no telling what's coming, but it might, like, might be better than that. So a very hopeful ending to this very dark movie, which I didn't realize was an R rating because I thought it was a movie kind of marketed to kids. And like, there were toys, there were action figures, and it's like got a child protagonist. But I was really taken aback watching this for the first time, how incredibly violent and graphic and brutal and dark it is.
Like, and profane.
Really, and profane. Like, it really, I was taken aback by it. But I had a great time watching it.
Somehow, I was young when that movie came out. Somehow, I saw it in the theater with my father. He took me to see Terminator 2. I saw it in the movie theater. I couldn't have been older than Eddie Furlong, who plays John Connor. I was probably his same age and kind of looked like him a little bit, just not as good looking, you know, because I wasn't a famous actor. I was just a regular kid. But I had like a similar haircut. I was super skinny. I was into baggy clothes and thought I was a badass when I really wasn't, just like John Connor does in this movie. So I highly identified with the kid character and thought he was so cool using an Atari to hack a bank.
Oh, yeah. It's great. Easy money.
Easy money. I can't believe my father took me to see this movie, considering that I was probably 11, maybe 12 at most, when I saw Terminator 2 in the theater.
But I feel like that was probably the experience of a lot of people, just because, was this before the PG-13 rating happened, or was this after?
Oh, this was well after.
This is well after. Okay. I was curious.
PG-13 was definitely a thing. You know, my father many ways instilled my love of cinema because he heard that it had the most revolutionary effects and he wanted to see it. And he took me because he knew how much I loved big special effects. And my dad had, and I growing up had always watched movies together. He had shown me all the classics when he was a kid, even more complex ones. Like, I've seen film noir when I was a child. Like, so he had exposed me to complex cinema, weird cinema, and on the fringe. So to him, you know, a bunch of robots blowing things up thematically wasn't any like darker than things I'd already experienced. So he wanted to see this and he knew I did. And he took me to the theater to see it.
That's awesome. You know, and it's also striking me at this moment that like we have danced around Mr. James Cameron and his filmography for a long time. We've been doing this podcast for 3.5 years and we tend to like make fun of James Cameron a little bit, you and me.
Or certainly Titanic.
It's certainly Titanic. I love to just like take the piss out of Avatar. But like, this is great. I mean, I think it holds up pretty well for a movie from the 90s and is strong. It has a good script. It's got a good message. And I think there's a lot that we can extrapolate from it. So I think it is significantly deeper than a lot of James Cameron's other work, although probably not as deep as The Abyss, because nothing can go as deep as The Abyss. but it's kind of fun that it's taken us so long to like get around to James Cameron's work, and that now we're doing so and taking it very seriously. And like, there are some really rich fruits that can be born from that.
I totally agree with that. Yeah. And I'm really, really excited to fully dive in here. So let's talk analysis. I agree. Yeah. Let me just say this. I agree. It holds up very well. The special effects are still great. There are movies that use CGI and combination of CGI and practical effects made today that don't look as good as Terminator did in the 90s. It is truly phenomenal. The one thing you have to give James Cameron, and the one thing he can do, is he can push the boundaries of what's technically possible in film, and it opens up the door for so many other filmmakers. And that is one of his great strengths as a director, as a major Hollywood director. And to me, T2 is his crowning achievement. I like a lot of James Cameron's movies, a lot I don't like. They're all exceptionally well made from a pure technical standpoint. But T2 to me is the rare synthesis of technical filmmaking, revolutionary techniques and styles, in particular in computer graphics, good acting, some acting better than others.
Yeah. Some of it is child acting.
And
some of it is Arnold Schwarzenegger. Some of it's Linda Hamilton.
A super compelling story and plenty to pause and reflect on, which will bring me to my first analysis question for you. If you were to sum up the theme of Terminator 2, if you could do that, if you could say, what is Terminator 2 thematically telling us, what do you think that would be?
To come up with like a theme statement is a complicated subject for me, because I tend to think that there is a little bit of a contradiction living at the center of Terminator 2. And maybe this is because I'm not familiar with the rest of the Terminator series. So a lot of this is a question mark for me.
Well, can I stop you right there?
Yeah.
F all the other movies.
Yeah.
Because I've seen
absolutely.
Them all. Like they're not relevant to me in the analysis of this. So I think we should look at this movie on its own.
Yeah. But the reason that I can't put out a thematic statement, and maybe we'll be able to do this by the end of this discussion. I know what it's about, but I don't know 100% what it's saying about that. So Terminator 2 is about fate and destiny and prophecy. It is about those concepts. It is about whether we can know the future or whether the future is predetermined or predestined for us. I don't know for sure if this movie makes an airtight argument one way or another as to whether there is a predestination or whether there is some wiggle room. So I think I'll want to dig into that question a little bit as we discuss.
I think that's fair. I do think the analysis of fate, the role of fate, is a theme and a major theme, in particular with the character Sarah Connor. And I think her struggle in the movie is a struggle dealing with, I know what'll happen, and it's really, really bleak, and nobody believes me, and I get persecuted for telling people what I know will happen. And you know, she gets ruined by the world she lives in because she knows what will happen. And she actively tries to change that as well. She tries to rewrite the future, so to speak. But I don't necessarily think that, to me, is the main theme.
Okay.
I think that's a major theme. But I think it comes down even simpler. Killing people is wrong.
Ooh, yeah.
And I think the moment that the Terminator and John Connor come in contact and he realizes the Terminator must follow his commands, what does he do? The very first thing, you're not allowed to kill anyone, period. And this starts the idea of teaching the Terminator that killing people is wrong. The machine was designed to kill people. At one point, he's sewing up Sarah Connor's back and John's like, do you know what you're doing? He's like, I have detailed files on human anatomy. And Sarah says, I guess that makes you a better killer. And he's like, you're correct. It does. But it's about teaching this machine the value of life and the idea that you cannot kill people. It's the last statement of the movie that a Terminator has learned the value of human life. And the idea is that killing people is wrong, no matter what. It even has the scene where John is looking at two little children pretend shooting each other. And he's like, oh my gosh, like they're pretending to terminate each other. Like, is there any hope? And the Terminator responds saying, you know, it is kind of in your nature to kill each other. And the reason for that is because all humans have ever done is try to kill each other. And if you can teach something the value of human life, if you can teach that killing people is wrong to an inanimate, cybernetic, synthetic life form, if you can get that lesson solidified, that's the thing that gives us hope that we're not just going to be able to, we're not just fated, rather, to blow each other up.
Yeah, I think that's great. And, you know, that's the core of the premise, too, is like, okay, we had this first movie where this robot was sent back through time and just like obliterated everyone because he's a killing machine. And then we had a new movie where we said, okay, what if the same machine, or, you know, a machine that looks the same and is the same model, was not that? What if he was a protector figure? Let's see what happens, what can be born if we try to change that persona. And it's a kind of brilliant premise, like to go from just that, you know, crazy action movie that's just like blood spraying everywhere to a movie that's still action, but it's built on a course of compassion. It's built on relationships, and it's built on, you know, changing the perception around something that is supposed to have this set programming. So I think that's really well said.
Yeah. And the biggest piece of evidence of the theme is that the Terminator's like, I'm not alive. In order to, even though I have a degree of consciousness, even though I have intelligence, even though I'm capable of learning, even though I have organic matter in part, I'm not alive. I'm not a human. And if I stay alive, humans will most likely end up killing each other, or at the very least, will kill each other on a faster, more accelerated pace. He sacrifices himself. Uncle Bob goes into the lava saying human life is so valuable that my own version of whatever kind of life I have, it's not worth it for me to exist, and chooses, makes a conscious choice, breaks the programming.
Yeah.
Because the programming doesn't allow Uncle Bob to self-terminate.
Yeah.
He says, I can't actually self-terminate. You'll have to lower me in. And like probably one of the best lines in the movie, when he looks at John and says, I know now why you cry, but it's something I can never do. He's admitting that I understand the value of life. I understand humans and emotions now. However, I am also not human, and human life is more valuable than what I am. And I'm willing to lay down my existence so that humans maybe get a few more years.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Right.
Who knows? But at least it's not definite that they will blow each other up
at this date in this time. Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to get into some mythology here, because I think there are tons of mythological parallels between Terminator 2 and, you know, the stories that we've told each other for centuries. And one of the biggest for me is this kind of child of prophecy track that I think so many of our myths take. It's something that we have talked about before. We did a podcast way early when we first started podcasting, and I think it was really one of our first really great episodes. So check that out if you want to, if you want to go back. It's called Destiny's Child. But the
blast from the past.
Yeah,
wow.
That was episode 8, I think. So I recommend it. I think it still holds up as far as our work goes. But this template, this child of prophecy template, it's in numerous cultures. It's generally a myth about a king who hears a prophecy that a child is about to be born who will grow up and overthrow him. That king, in turn, commits some atrocity, either arranging for the murder of that child or of multiple children in order to avert the prophecy. So we recognize it in Oedipus being left out to die, or Perseus being prophesied to overthrow his grandfather.
Moses.
It's Moses. It's King Arthur and his son Mordred. In response to hearing that a child of his would overthrow him, Arthur has all the children born on May Day slaughtered. But Mordred somehow gets through and still ends up dealing him a mortal blow. It's really similar to the biblical episode of the Massacre of the Innocents, during which King Herod, hearing a very similar prophecy, has all the babies in the kingdom slaughtered, but of course Jesus survives. The most common outcome of these stories, of this same template, is that the prophesied child survives. The fate cannot be averted, and they fulfill their destiny, and they overthrow the tyrant or the king. And what's interesting, I think, about that is that we have so many examples of, you know, you can't outwit the gods have ordained this fate, or the one God has ordained this fate. It's impossible to stop this prophecy once it's been set in motion. But there is an example from Greek mythology of things turning out a different way. So I'd love to talk about that a little bit. We all know the story, and we talk about it a lot, of Cronus, the Titan, consuming his children because he's told that one of them will be stronger than him. Zeus, of course, ends up surviving and becoming the king of the gods. But Zeus himself has a similar myth. Before he was married to Hera, he had a wife named Metis, who was a titaness in Greek mythology. She's attested by Hesiod and some other writers. She's associated with wisdom and cunning and wit, and she's part of the second generation of titans after Cronus was overthrown. So it was foretold that Metis would bear two extremely powerful children, one being Athena and the other being a son who was powerful enough to overthrow Zeus himself. Now, in response to hearing this prophecy, of course, Zeus did not want that to happen, so he managed to trick Metis into turning herself into a fly, and he swallowed her. Now, at this point, she was already pregnant with Athena, and so while she's in Zeus's body, she sets about hammering out Athena's armor, and that banging and pounding gives Zeus a terrible headache, which then he goes to Hephaestus and is like, help me with this terrible headache, and Hephaestus strikes him across the head with a hammer, and out bursts Athena, fully armored and fully formed already. Thus, Zeus succeeds in changing the prophecy. The daughter's born, but he never conceives the son because Metis has been swallowed. So he snuffs out the existence of this future son and deposer by destroying his wife. It's a rare example of this sort of child of prophecy narrative where the child is never born, or the child never comes to existence, or the child is destroyed before they can depose the king. And that's something we don't see very often, but that's very much at the core of why the Terminator movies keep happening. It's like, okay, let's go back and kill John Connor so he can't resist us. And the first movie, I know that they go back before he's even born and try to destroy Sarah Connor. But in this one, they go back and try to kill him while he's a child because they are convinced, Skynet is convinced, that you know, there is a world where you can stop him from rising up against the machines. So that's part of the reason why I'm interested in this question of fate when it comes to Terminator, because we do hear very clearly articulated from both Sarah and from John Connor, the future is not set. There is no fate but what we make for ourselves. But we also see that, you know, we have this long history of myths that the fate is sealed once the prophecy is foretold. So why should we believe that the future can really be changed? And we also have a line from the Terminator where he says, it's in your nature to destroy yourselves. So if it's in our nature, can we really truly change the future? So I'm interested in that kind of tension.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Yeah, really, really interesting thoughts. So in the Zeus and Athena story, in which Zeus thwarts the birth of his son, if we map that onto Terminator 2, you're saying Zeus is Skynet.
Yeah. Yeah, Zeus is Skynet. And Zeus, these don't have to be one-to-one comparisons, but...
Right. If we... So, yes... One thing that we see consistently, in particular in ancient myth and ancient thinking, is the idea of somewhat divine, somewhat human beings, like a Perseus or Hercules, who are children usually of divine conception, where a god comes and puts a child in the belly of a human woman, and she births a half-god, half-human. A demigod is where we get that term from. And that often there is this idea that this demigod, this super heroic individual, might overthrow the current regime. And these things are about tensions and pulls of generations. They're about trying to understand the cycles of life, death, and rebirth. They're about understanding why political systems and things like tyrannies can exist. And they're also fundamentally about resigning the ancient self to the whims of fate. Understanding there's only so much control that you can have. If even Moses and Perseus are going to be subject and bound by the laws of these greater forces, so must I. I must accept where I'm at in this fate. With Zeus thwarting, right, the prophecy is emblematic of him being the supreme of all gods. The god of all gods doesn't get overthrown.
Yeah.
Right? And if you are the god of all gods, you bend prophecy to your will. You're the prophecy maker, you're not the prophecy follower.
You're not driven by prophecy. Yeah.
And so Zeus being able to overthwart that is, it's somewhat symbolic of humans' ability to try to control everything and to be able to shape the world as they want. But it's also about Zeus being Zeus, right? Skynet in many ways does map pretty clearly to this. Skynet has the word sky in it. Zeus is god of what? The sky and thunder. We see a bleak world with black clouds. What are the weapons that we see the Terminators use in the future in this movie? Blue bolts like lightning. You know, they very much seem like they are artifacts of this and trying to bend the destiny to their will, not through magical powers, but rather through scientific principles of time travel to say, we're going to bend fate. We're going to rewrite the past so our enemy isn't here. And I think that maps really interestingly to Zeus itself. Conversely, now we have the humans, and I wonder how much this movie wants to really delve into the metaphysics of it. It's a movie about time travel that's not about time travel.
Yeah.
In the way that a movie like 12 Monkeys is really about the mechanics of time travel. And can you actually change an event if you know about the future? If you go back in time and you know that things are going to happen, can you actually change things? Or will you put in place the very things that doom that bad thing to happen? And this movie's not fully invested in that because it ends open. Like, it doesn't say whether Judgment Day does or doesn't happen.
Yeah.
It doesn't say one way or another if they've thwarted Skynet or Skynet will still happen. And because of that, it leaves that question a little more open-ended. It does seem to delve deeply into the free will of individuals. So some piece of textual evidence. One, John Connor makes tons of decisions. He defies his foster parents. He decides to be a criminal. He decides to bust his mom out of the mental institution. The Terminator learns to outthink the Terminator's programming. This is Uncle Bob. So Uncle Bob, Arnold Schwarzenegger, he learns the value of life. He learns the value of emotions. He learns to connect to a child and truly care about John. It's not just the programming. And then Sarah, who decides that she's going to, you know, thwart the future by trying to kill Miles Dyson, then learns, I can't kill him. Killing him is wrong. He didn't actually do this yet. And to me, if it's with that much evidence that individuals can make choices, even synthetic individuals can make choices, it leads me to a road of free will, which leads me to a road of it's not deterministic, which says to me the future isn't set, which means these characters aren't bound by fate. and they aren't bound, whether that fate is from a transcendental power like Zeus or God, or bound by the laws of physics like time travel is. And to me, it does seem to be more on the side of people can choose.
Yeah. Just one more example I'll throw in there as an agent of free will is Miles Dyson himself, who after, you know, nearly being killed by Sarah Connor, they sit him down and explain to him what Skynet will become. And like, this is a well-intentioned man who loves his family and who is genuinely trying to like make the world better through technology, just without the forethought of realizing the consequences of what he's making. And once he's told the consequences, it's profound, the change that he goes through, and to make the choice to be like, okay, I'll destroy my life's work and all evidence of my life's work is definitely an argument for the case towards free will. So I think, yeah, I think you really got the button on it. My sort of question and hesitation about all of it is that, yes, it just leaves us open on this, you know, forward moving highway where, yeah, we know we destroyed all the evidence of Skynet, but are we just headed for the same fate via many paths? And maybe I'm, you know, reading this pessimistically because I can see the world as we have it today. I can see how technology has advanced. I can see how much of our privacy we have surrendered to corporations in order to, you know, give them our data so that they can make our lives more convenient. I've seen, you know, us progress towards self-driving cars and greater artificial intelligence. And so there's just a part of me that wonders, is there any way to stop Skynet? Is there any way to stop us from getting to the technological singularity? I'd love to talk just a little bit about the technological singularity because I think there's some fun stuff about it that ties in our whole sci-fi series.
Yeah, please do.
Because that's what Skynet is. It's a concept that is driven by the singularity, which is a hypothetical scenario in which technological advancement just gets totally out of control and humans no longer have the ability to drive it. It's just driving itself. So a version of the singularity is called the intelligence explosion. And that supposes that humans could create an AI that's capable of such self-improvement that it surpasses all human intelligence and leaves us in the dust and becomes a super intelligence, therefore threatening human existence. Skynet, absolutely. It just improves itself so much that we can no longer even touch it. And while the concept of the singularity has been around since at least the 18th century before it was really named, the intelligence explosion hypothesis was pioneered by a British mathematician named I.J. Goode, who worked alongside Alan Turing at Bletchley Park during the Second World War and cracked German naval codes with him while working on early computer designs. So he's a character in the 2014 movie The Imitation Game, and as an expert on computation and early supercomputers, he consulted with a guy named Stanley Kubrick on 2001, A Space Odyssey. So he's kind of the architect of HAL. And I just could not do this episode without sharing that little fun fact there.
I think that is so amazing. You know, there are so many fun little happy coincidences in doing this podcast project that we have. And one of them is seeing the connection that the idea, the birth of thinking machines, later to be dubbed computers, links to 2001, A Space Odyssey. And here we are a few weeks later discussing the role of artificial intelligence and its role in relationship to humanity, connecting these themes the entire way. I mean, there's one story, it's the Midnight Myth, and we're all just figuring out little pieces of it at a time.
Absolutely.
I think that's beautiful. And I do think Terminator 2 has a cautionary tale about technology. And it does say technological advancement for technological advancement's sake, if it's not humanized in its very nature, it's amoral in its very nature. And there's a few pieces of evidence of this. Sarah says to Miles that you don't know what it's like to create a life. You don't know what it's like. People like you, Miles, thought up the atom bomb, right? People like you think you're so creative, but you really are life negating. We see evidence that Miles spends a little more time with his work than his family. He's more into his work than he is spending time with the actual lives he's created. He's more invested in creating fake life than fathering the actual life he's created. We also see in the movie where he is asked by one of his coworkers, where did this stuff come from? And he says, you know, I asked the same thing once. You know what I was told? What? Don't ask. A stark warning about conformity. If you have amazing technology that you're trying to understand, but your central premise is to don't ask, the way that this entire apparatus works is don't ask where it came from, just replicate it, is a level of human hubris. It's a level of just anti-science within the science that is epistemologically absurd. If you're trying to understand what this technology is and how it works, you must know where it comes from.
And you have to know why you're doing it. You have to know why.
And it's so absurd on its face value that the idea to me is technology for the sake of technology, without humanizing it, without attaching a Sarah Connor level of, believe it or not, I'd say empathy. Because even though she's cold and ruthless and maniacal and militant, it's all about trying to save other lives. She's doing it not because she's heartless. She's doing it because she cares.
And that sort of dichotomy of the kind of masculine and feminine aspects of technology or of advancement or evolution is something that we've come back to time and again in this series in particular. We talked about it a lot with 2001. It came up in Alien. It came up in Star Trek, this idea of creation and destruction as being, you know, parts of the same cycle or parts of the same system. And I'm glad that you brought up that scene where Sarah Connor confronts Dyson and is like, you have no idea what it's like to create a life, because I think she's an amazing character. I mean, this was actually my first real encounter with her, though I have known about her for so long because of the Sarah Connor Chronicles and like every Terminator movie that comes out, you know that she exists in the popular consciousness. But this is my first time seeing her in a movie. And I'm like, really impressed with her, because where we talked about Ripley 2 weeks ago as this amazing woman character in this sci-fi story as a survivor and as, you know, someone who makes great decisions and is strategic, and her femininity is part of her, but it's not like, it's not a huge part. With Sarah Connor, it is a huge part. The fact that she is a woman is key, is like, you cannot take that aspect away from her. The fact that she is a mother, the fact that she is that she experiences the kinds of experiences that she does when she's detained are very gendered, and they make her stronger as a person and as a, you know, as a character, as how she's written.
I totally agree. Let's talk Sarah Connor, because in many ways, I mean, I love Arnold Schwarzenegger and I love Uncle Bob. I just kind of started calling him Uncle Bob.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because the Terminator doesn't have a name. Because technically,
he's the Model 101. Yeah.
The T-1000 and the Terminator, like, they're both Terminators. So I'm just calling him Uncle Bob because that's what he gets called.
Yeah, he's a teddy bear.
Absolutely. He's Uncle Bob. I love Arnold Schwarzenegger. I love Uncle Bob. And I love The Sacrifice. And I've always been a big Arnold Schwarzenegger fan. You know, like, I love all of his movies. I genuinely do. I grew up in the 80s and the 90s watching Arnold Schwarzenegger destroy things, and I loved it.
Jingle All the Way forever.
Don't go that far. That's a bad movie. But Sarah Connor, to me, is the character that connects this entire movie. Without Linda Hamilton's performance, this movie wouldn't be a solid movie to me. It's the glue. And I like that we were talking mythology, and I'd like to connect Sarah to mythology.
Yeah,
because
please.
I do think, as much as we can understand Skynet as a Zeus trying to thwart the prophecy, I think we can understand Sarah Connor mythologically as well, and mythologically feminine. And that, to me, would be the myth of Cassandra. Now, Cassandra is an awesome myth. It relates to the Trojan War. Cassandra is a Trojan. She is beautiful. And she is courted by Apollo. And Apollo promises to give her the ability to prophesize, to see the future, something that Apollo can do. And all he asks in return is a kiss. So he gives her this, she agrees, and she sees the future with Apollo blessing Greeks destroying Troy, and she's disgusted by him and can't kiss him. So we can't take away this gift of prophecy because even gods are bound by rules. So what does he do? He gives her the blessing of prophecy, but he also curses her that no one should know or believe when she's telling them their future. Gifted with the power to see the future, but robbed of the ability to convince anyone that the future is real, makes Cassandra a tragic, tragic hero of one of many of the Trojan War. Cassandra recognized when the Trojan horse was sitting out front of the gates of Troy that the Trojan horse was going to kill them. She warned everyone, don't bring them in, we'll all die. But no one believed her. Sarah Connor is very much a modern Cassandra in that she knows for a fact that Judgment Day is going to happen, and she is trying to warn the entire world that Judgment Day will happen, and she gets imprisoned, she gets detained, she gets licked, she gets beaten, and she ultimately is treated like a lab rat for the idea of simply being a woman with knowledge. And I reflect on the myth of Cassandra, and it's really, we have to understand when we think of the Trojan War, we think of the myths around the Trojan War, the legends. If Troy were the city that the myths say, it would have happened in a period during which we call the Archaic Greek or Mediterranean period. This is before there's a Greek language. This is a period that collapsed. And this is when, if there was a Menelaus, a Helen of Troy, an Achilles, this is when they would have lived. And this is when, from archaeological evidence tells us, where we think Troy was, where Troy was destroyed, and when Troy was destroyed. No one knows what happened to cause the collapse of the Archaic period, but it's roughly around 1200 BCE. Around this time, the entire ancient world collapsed. The only society that really prospered was ancient Egypt. The predominant theory, and no one knows, was climate change. Mass famine built upon the change of climate. Could this have been caused by a volcanic eruption? Maybe. Could this have been caused by a comet? Maybe. No one really knows, but that's the best theory we can come up with because we're talking about the prehistoric time. And by the time Homer was writing down the Iliad and the Odyssey, and the Greeks were using the Trojan War as a foundational Greek story, there was no Troy, and there wasn't a Troy for a long period of time. This is to say, everything we know and understand about Troy of myth and of history and where those intersect comes from their enemies. It comes from the Greeks. Establishing Cassandra as the prophet of Troy that was not believed is a foundational myth around the duplicity, the untrustworthiness of female power. It's about establishing the Greek world, which built the Western civilization we now live in, but built it as fundamentally patriarchal.
Patriarchal, yeah.
With men at the top. Of course no one believes the woman soothsayer. Of course the woman blessed by Apollo was also cursed by Apollo.
And of course she's cursed by him because she won't deign to give him a kiss.
Because she did it to herself.
Yeah.
All she had to do was kiss a god.
Ugh.
All she had to do was succumb sexually to a male figure who wanted to control her. She did it to herself. She deserved it as the Trojans deserved it. Flashing forward to Terminator and skipping over thousands of years of patriarchy, we have Sarah Connor in a patriarchal world armed with the foreknowledge and cursed to be not believed. Not believed by her own son. And it isn't until irrefutable proof happens and she gets violently freed, because she's not walking out of this insane asylum. It's a maximum security prison/insane asylum. It's the Arkham Asylum, if you will. It's not until she is violently freed by males, even though the Terminator is technically not a male, but he's a male. until she is violently freed by males, she would be condemned to die in this mental institution, knowing the entire time what would happen with irrefutable proof and evidence. It is men who covered up in Skynet. It is men who use the evidence to build Skynet. It is men who are persecuting her, who are beating her, who are medicating her against her will, and are telling her that she's crazy when she's actually right. And it isn't until men come and free her. I think there's an interesting meditation when we reflect on this, when we ask ourselves, what is it with smart women? Why is it that we're so uncomfortable with it? And we have to start with Cassandra. We have to go back to, well, the smartest woman of Troy was ignored and destroyed. And why? Why was she ignored and destroyed? Because she didn't make out with Apollo.
I'm just kind of letting that sink in because I knew the myth of Cassandra, obviously, but I hadn't really thought about it in that context. And to map that onto Sarah Connor, I think is really powerful. And both of those characters, mythological or, you know, starring in a blockbuster movie, I think have incredible resonance today when we talk about believing women and we talk about, you know, the stories coming to light with the Me Too movement and how we gather and understand testimony today, how we, you know, figure out who it is that we believe. So I'm kind of just meditating on that right now because I think that was a really powerful statement that you just made and really does come to solidify why I think Sarah Connor is such a strong character because she is in many ways, she plays against type. She plays against, you know, the heroine of most movies. She's very different from those, but she's very much in touch with her womanhood and her motherhood, and is very, very committed to both her kind of violent procedure or violent process, the fact that she will stop at nothing to get what she wants, but the fact that that intention is incredibly pure and is incredibly life-affirming. Like, she wants to save children. She is haunted by visions of children dying. So, like, she's willing to do whatever it takes to fix it. But what she's trying to fix is like a greater injustice.
And you haven't seen the first Terminator movie.
Right.
She is just a damsel in distress in the first Terminator movie. All she is pretty and being tossed around by powerful men who are trying to kill her / save her. And that's all she is. And when this movie came out, seeing Linda Hamilton become the Sarah Connor of T2 was a shock.
Yeah, I mean, the first shot of her is her doing pull-ups in a prison cell on a bed frame she's overturned.
And because in the first movie, she's just a pretty blonde girl who likes having fun with her roommate, who is just needs to be saved by all of this evil machine by another male soldier who comes and helps her. And she's just a victim being pushed from scene to scene and needs to be saved. And the whole purpose of the first movie is save Sarah Connor. The second movie, Sarah Connor does the saving.
Yeah, she does drives the killing. All of the action. She has all of the agency. It's amazing.
It is fantastic. She was escaping when Terminator comes and gets her. You know, Uncle Bob comes to fight the T-1000. She was almost out, like by herself, like she had made it to the elevator. So she had nearly escaped completely on her own. And that transformation sent ripples through popular culture. Like, oh my God, look at Linda Hamilton.
Yeah.
Like,
she got in like major shape for this role.
And everyone was just like, is that the same actor? Did they cast someone different? Like, it sent ripples because she is so powerful and because she is such a strong character. And that's why Sarah Connor to date has the effect, has the name like Ripley that we had from Alien.
Yeah, absolutely. She's definitely a pop culture force to be reckoned with. And she's gone on to be played by, you know, women like Lena Headey and Emilia Clarke, too. So it's something that people want to keep revisiting. And then she appears in the latest Terminator movie, too. And Linda Hamilton comes back and is still just as badass as ever before.
Yeah, totally. But I do think, you know, there's an element of the patriarchy that is implicitly being interrogated in this movie. And I think if we map it backwards, we have to understand that our patriarchy is thousands of years old and that it started in ancient Greece, that established, and myths like Cassandra are the foundations. There are others. There are others in ancient Greece, but that is one that is incredibly relevant to Terminator, because Cassandra and Sarah Connor separated by different storytelling traditions and thousands of years suffer from the same problem, which is knowing something men don't know and them not being listened to.
You know, another thing that I'm reflecting on as we compare these mythological traditions to Terminator is the role that women play in those Child of Prophecy stories. So in the Zeus and Cronus story, it's Zeus's mother who's the one who thwarts Cronus's plan to devour all of his children, and she helps to save her child. In stories like the story of Moses or even of Oedipus, it's women who find the child afloat on the river or abandoned on the hill who take the child in and raise them and make sure they can come to manhood. So there is this this kind of mothering role that is always a huge part of these Child of Prophecy stories that is obviously not the direct antecedent of Sarah Connor, because she is so much more than just a mother. But those participants in the story can't be erased. The fact that destiny has to be fulfilled in those stories, that the child has to be protected by someone, and that someone is usually a feminine presence.
And perhaps it is in our nature to destroy ourselves. And maybe Skynet and the singularity is an inevitable point in our future, that it's just not a matter of if, but a matter of when. But along the way, we can be better. And I think Terminator 2, in that way, you said you had a bit of a pessimistic read, but in that way, Terminator 2 is an optimistic read for me. And I think one of the lessons I take up to this point with our sci-fi series is that even in the darkest, most dystopian sci-fi, there's an air of optimism implicit in it, because humans made it there. So even in Terminator 2, even if Judgment Day is unavoidable, the humans will make it there.
We know there's a resistance. We know that there's a John Connor to lead it. So,
so powerful it is that the machines try to bend the laws of time in order to thwart it. We know that we can endure. And I think that is the most powerful thing that you can say about sci-fi if you're trying to reflect on the human condition, is that we're indomitable.
Yeah.
And we will get there. We will get through it. And I think right now, in a world of economic collapse, social unrest, the rise of authoritarianism, and global disease, it's easy to lose sight of that. It's easy to think we are all going to be swept up in the crises and problems of today. And many of us are. A lot of people have died right now. A lot. And more probably will. And that is in no small part to the failure of global leaders to contain a global problem. But we're, as a species, we are going to get through this, and we will be there in the future one way or another. And we are going to, no matter what, we are going to unite and we are going to beat Skynet down.
Well, and it's not a given, right? You know, we can't just sit back and watch whatever is coming our way and just say, well, the human spirit is indomitable, so we'll make it through. Like, it requires incredibly hard work.
I didn't mean to imply that, if that's what you were thinking.
No, I'm just adding that on, because that's, I think, what this movie is saying, is that, okay, so the future is not set. There's no fate but what we make for ourselves. But that implies like an incredible amount of taking it into your own hands. You have to make it for yourself. So Sarah Connor embarking on this this mission to destroy all evidence of Skynet is an incredibly difficult task. Like, you would think just going into your office and like shredding some files would not be that difficult, but they end up like blowing up a building and losing one of their party members along the way. It is a life or death mission to shred some files in the office. So it's like the future that we make for ourselves, the fate that we make for ourselves, is not something we can sit back and let just happen. It's something that we have to show up for every single day, like a job, and work on. And one of those things that we have to work on is what Sarah Connor is reflecting on in the final moments of the movie. If a Terminator can learn the value of human life, maybe we can too. It ends on a maybe, because we have to show up to work and make sure that we are doing what needs to be done to elicit empathy, to teach empathy. Because the Terminator can't learn empathy on his own. He has to be taught by John Connor. So I think that's the other aspect of that to take away from it. It's like, take the action into your own hands. There is no future but what we make for ourselves. Show up, do the work.
And let's make a future.
Yeah.
Boom. And until next time, be kind.
Hasta la vista, baby.